university. While each mind virus constitutes a different strain of lunacy, they are all bound by the full rejection of reality and common sense. Postmodernism rejects the existence of objective truths. Radical feminism scoffs at the idea of innate, biologically based sex differences. And social constructivism posits that the human mind starts off as an empty slate, largely void of biological blueprints. This general class of mind viruses is what I have coined ostrich parasitic syndrome, OPS, namely various forms of disordered thinking that lead afflicted individuals to reject fundamental truths and realities that are as evident as the pull of gravity. In a similar vein to how all forms of cancer share a mechanism of unchecked cell division, these mind viruses all reject truth in the defense of a pet ideology. The ideological tribe to which one belongs varies across the mind viruses, but the commitment is always to the defense of one's dogma. Truth and science be damned. All is not lost, though. OPS need not be a terminal disease of the human mind. Recall that many biological pathogens are defeated by targeted intervention strategies, like the polio vaccine. The same applies to those afflicted with OPS and associated mind viruses. The inoculation against such cancerous mindsets comes in the form of a two-step cognitive vaccine. One, providing OPS sufferers with accurate information, and two, ensuring that OPS sufferers learn how to process information according to the evidentiary rules of science and logic. In his 1976 classic, The Selfish Gene, evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins famously introduced the concept of the meme to our public consciousness. Memes are packets of information that spread from one brain to another. In reading this book, your brain is infected by my memes. If you then discuss my ideas within your social circle, my memes are further propagated. Not all memes are created equal, though, be it in terms of their valence, positive, neutral, or negative, or their virulence, how quickly they spread. The Ice Bucket campaign to combat amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, colloquially known as Lou Gehrig's disease, yielded rapidly viral YouTube clips, all in the pursuit of a worthy cause. On the other hand, other memes might take longer to spread, for instance, a death cult religious belief, though they yield astonishingly dire consequences, convincing people that it is a divine act to fly airplanes into skyscrapers. From this perspective, OPS is a mimetic disease of the human mind. When facing a pathogenic epidemic, we call on modern-day dragon slayers, namely infectious disease specialists and epidemiologists, to intervene. They defend us against a broad range of monstrous pathogens dead set on infecting us. Part of their job description is to understand where a pathogen originates, the manner and speed by which it spreads, the identity of the first person to be infected, patient zero, and how do we eradicate it? This is precisely the approach that must be taken in defeating parasitic viruses of the human mind. Where do these infectiously bad ideas come from? How are they spread? Which ecosystem do they flourish in? How do we inoculate people against their devastating effects? That is the task of this book. It is an exploration of the epidemiology of mind pathogens and the intervention strategies that will allow us to wrestle back reason from the enemies of truth. Death of the West by a Thousand Cuts. The greatness of the West stems in part from its protection of fundamental freedoms and its commitment to reason and the scientific method where appropriate. Over the past few decades, though, several nefarious forces have slowly eroded the West's commitment to reason, science, and the values of the Enlightenment. See Figure 1 in the PDF. Such forces include political correctness, as enforced by the thought police, the language police, and social justice warriors. Postmodernism, radical feminism, social constructivism, cultural and moral relativism, and the culture of perpetual offense and victimhood, microaggressions, trigger warnings, and safe spaces on campuses, as well as identity politics. This has created an environment that has stifled public discourse in a myriad of ways. Academics shy away from investigating so-called forbidden topics. such as sex differences or racial differences, lest they be accused of being rabidly sexist or racist. Professors are intimidated into using nonsensical gender pronouns when addressing students, lest they otherwise be committing a hate crime. See, for instance, Canada's Bill C-16. University students demand that they be, quote, protected from ideas that are antithetical to their own, while being warned by administrators about wearing, quote, offensive Halloween costumes. Politicians are fearful to critique Islam or open-border immigration policies, lest they be accused of being bigots. More generally, people are deathly afraid to espouse any opinion that might get them ostracized from the politically correct club. Try being a conservative Republican in Hollywood or on a university campus. These trepidations are weakening our culture because we are no longer able to talk with one another using rational and reasoned discourse that is otherwise free from a dogmatic and tribal mindset. In this book, I set out to describe the confluence of forces that are endangering the West's commitment to freedom, reason, and true liberalism, hence the death of the West by a thousand cuts. Ultimately, any attempt to limit what individuals can think or say weakens the defining ethos of the West, namely the unfettered commitment to the pursuit of truth, unencumbered by the shackles of the thought police. A few books have addressed the spread of anti-intellectual, anti-reason, anti-science, and anti-liberal sentiment, and the specific movements that give rise to them: postmodernism, radical feminism, multiculturalism as a political philosophy, and identity politics. This book weaves together all of these nefarious forces, along with new ones, to explain how they gave rise to the current stifling political correctness, which is enforced by the thought police, along with its army of social justice warriors, a recent phenomenon. It offers an up-to-date examination of the current cultural zeitgeist on campuses and in public discourse. Finally, it highlights how these anti-freedom, anti-honesty movements have substantive consequences in the real world. They explain the West's inability to have a frank and reasoned discussion about the place of Islam within our secular, liberal, and modern societies. They also help explain the popular reaction against political correctness and its threats to freedom and honesty that we saw in the stunning ascendancy of Donald Trump to the presidency of the United States. Unless we win the battle of ideas, the enemies of reason, along with the mind viruses that they promulgate, will lead our free societies to lunatic self-destruction. Chapter 2: Thinking versus Feeling. Truth versus Hurt Feelings. Reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions, and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. David Hume. I always felt that a scientist owes the world only one thing, and that is the truth as he sees it. If the truth contradicts deeply held beliefs, that is too bad. Tact and diplomacy are fine in international relations, in politics, perhaps even in business. In science, only one thing matters, and that is the facts. Hans J. Eysenck. In describing a debate on the existence of God with Doug Givett, currently a professor of philosophy at the Talbot School of Theology of Biola University, my good friend and founder of the Skeptics Society, Michael Shermer, remarked, "Givett concluded his initial presentation by explaining that we are confronted here with an either-or choice. Either God exists or he does not. Either the universe was created or it was not. Either life was designed or it was not. Either morality is natural or it is not. Either Jesus was resurrected or he was not." I opened up my rebuttal by explaining that there are only two types of theories, those that divide the world into two types of theories, and those that do not. Shermer's brilliant levity carries an important epistemological message, namely that the pursuit of knowledge does not always neatly fit into clean dichotomies. The penchant of many researchers to map phenomena onto binary realities is what I've coined epistemological dichotomania. It stems from a desire to create a workable and simplified view of the world that is amenable to scientific testing. Of note, the dichotomies are at times largely false, such as the nature-nurture debate. In the words of the biologist Matt Ridley, nature versus nurture is dead. Much of who we are arises from an indissoluble amalgam of our genes and our environments. Furthermore, universal patterns of socialization, nurture, exist in their forms because of biological imperatives, nature. The desire to divide the world into binary forms is at the root of the thinking versus feeling dichotomy, and this creates a false either-or mindset. We are both thinking and feeling animals. The challenge is to know when to activate the cognitive, thinking, versus the affective, feeling systems. When you think of perfume commercials, what comes to mind? You are unlikely to see a Harvard chemist in a lab coat explaining the chemical equation of the aromatic recipe used in making the product. Similarly, the brand's name is unlikely to be a technical name, such as anisaldehyde eugenol X2000. Instead, the typical perfume commercial sells sex, romance, fantasy, and passion. A beautiful woman with long, flowing hair might be shown riding a horse, followed by a one-word brand name such as obsession, escape, allure, mystère, or désir, all actual brand names. Perfumes are hedonic products, and as such, they must engage our emotions. If one were designing a commercial for a mutual fund, the commercial's content, as well as the fund's brand name, would be radically different. In this case, given that a mutual fund is a functional and utilitarian product, the commercial must engage the viewer's cognitive system. A beautiful endorser might convince you to purchase a perfume, but not to invest in a mutual fund. The elaboration likelihood model posits that consumers use one of two routes of persuasion when processing a message. The central route involves cognitive effort. Namely, the consumer will carefully evaluate the message's substantive informational content, such as the seven reasons why a particular mutual fund is the best one to invest in. The peripheral route, on the other hand, relies on the use of non-substantive cues in arriving at an attitude, using an endorser's physical attractiveness in forming an attitude toward investing in a mutual fund. In this case, the peripheral cue is not directly relevant in judging the logical merits of the message. The route that is activated depends on a consumer's motivation and ability to process information. Generally speaking, an attitude wherein the affective and cognitive components are consistent with one another will be more resistant to change. See, for example, Rosenberg's affective-cognitive consistency model. The negative hysteria surrounding Donald Trump is rooted in peripheral processing. His mannerisms disgust me. Trump's detractors should perhaps be spending more effort engaging their central route of persuasion by evaluating his policy positions in a dispassionate and detached manner. Hierarchy of effects models have been used in marketing and advertising to describe the cognitive, thinking, affective, feeling, and conative behavioral stages that consumers go through after seeing or hearing an advertisement. Products that require a high level of involvement, choosing a mutual fund, will have a different sequence of effects from their low-involvement counterparts, buying a candy bar. For the former, the operative sequence is thinking, feeling, behavior. An informed opinion leads to liking the product, hence its purchase. On the other hand, for impulse products, it is feeling, behavior, thinking. A positive feeling leads to an impulse purchase, and the opinion is formed post-purchase. Inherent to the various sequences is the recognition that both cognition and emotions matter in the decision-making process. In other words, we do not need to construe thinking and feeling as antithetical to one another. They are both fundamental components of decision-making. Problems arise when we use the wrong sequence to make a decision. For example, choosing which presidential candidate to vote for should be construed as a high-involvement decision. And accordingly, a rational voter should first engage his cognitive system rather than his affective system. And yet, Many hysterical anti-Trump voters begin with a visceral, emotional hatred of the man and then process subsequent information in a manner that supports their a priori effective position. The classic saying, "Don't let your emotions get the best of you," is an apt descriptor of how many people regard sound decision-making. From this perspective, a rational person thinks, an irrational person feels. Classical economists have traditionally thought of human beings as hyper-rational agents who make cost-benefit decisions. The archetype of a good decision-maker is Mr. Spock from Star Trek, a hyper-logical agent without emotional distractions. I recall an address by the economist George Lowenstein at the 1995 International Association for Research in Economic Psychology conference in Bergen, Norway, wherein he implored economists to incorporate visceral states such as lust, anger, hunger, and fear into our understanding of human decision-making. In listening to his lecture, I kept thinking, no kidding, who doesn't know this? As a young assistant professor at the time, I was astonished that this should be news to anyone, let alone to sophisticated economic psychologists. It seems self-evident to me that it is perfectly rational to be an emotional being when one's emotions are applied in the proper context. Emotions such as happiness, fear, lust, disgust, or envy serve as solutions to recurring evolutionary challenges that our ancestors have faced. Take romantic jealousy. Which of the following two scenarios is more emotionally painful for you to imagine? Your spouse committing sexual infidelity or committing emotional infidelity? Evolutionary psychologist David Buss and his colleagues showed that men respond more harshly to sexual infidelity, as this raises a fear of uncertain paternity about children, while women are more upset by emotional infidelity, as this serves as a greater predictor of a man's lack of commitment to a long-term union. Men and women respond to infidelity according to the mating challenges of their sex. The triggered emotions are perfectly rational when viewed through an evolutionary lens. In his 2011 best-selling book, Thinking, Fast and Slow, Nobel laureate Daniel Kahneman argued that humans are endowed with two systems of thinking. System 1, composed of fast, intuitive, automatic, unconscious, emotional, and instinctive processes, and System 2, made up of slow, deliberate, analytical, logical, and conscious processes. It is hardly surprising that humans are endowed with the capacity to use a broad range of cognitive and affective strategies when making decisions. Nor is it surprising that people differ in the extent to which they rely on feelings versus thinking when making choices. The problem arises when domains that should be reserved for the intellect are hijacked by feelings. This is precisely what plagues our universities. What were once centers of intellectual development have become retreats for the emotionally fragile. The driving motto of the university is no longer the pursuit of truth, but the coddling of hurt feelings. Truth versus hurt feelings. On October 15, 2017, with Wikipedia as my research tool, I conducted a quick and obviously informal analysis of university mottos. I found that there were 128 matches for the word truth, 46 matches for the word wisdom, 61 matches for the word science, and 0 matches for the words emotion or feeling. For example, Harvard's motto is Veritas, truth, and Yale's is Lux et Veritas, light and truth. These venerable institutions of higher learning were not founded on an ethos of feelings, but on the dogged pursuit of truth. And yet, across all our institutions, from universities to the media to the judicial system to the political arena, truth is increasingly taking a back seat to feelings. This is true in the United States, it is true in Canada, and it is true across most of the Western world. An extraordinarily chilling and instructive example of this dreadful trend occurred in the Netherlands in 2010. Geert Wilders, a Dutch parliamentarian, was charged with a slew of crimes for having the temerity to criticize Islam and its growing influence in his country. Any freedom-loving reader should be appalled that criticism of a religion is now considered hate speech in many Western countries. As part of his defense strategy, Mr. Wilders sought to call on expert witnesses to validate the veracity of his stated public positions. The response from the prosecutor's office, open bar ministeri, was truly breathtaking. It is irrelevant whether Wilders' witnesses might prove Wilders' observations to be correct. What's relevant is that his observations are illegal. In a free society, people should have the right to criticize a religion. They should have the right to do so. And of course, their criticisms are themselves open to criticism. That is the essence of freedom of speech and thought. In this case, the prosecution was beyond Orwellian, stating flatly that telling the truth could be illegal. This mindset is increasingly prevalent in academia, and it falls under the rubric of forbidden knowledge. See the recent case of Noah Carle, who dared to support researchers' right to study the relationship between race and intelligence. In August 2017, I made my fifth appearance on the Joe Rogan Experience. For those of you unfamiliar with the podcast, it is a conversational marathon that typically lasts just shy of 3 hours. During our conversation, Joe asked me about the scientific pursuit of potentially sensitive topics. Here is the relevant excerpt. Me. When I was on Sam Harris's show, you know, earlier this year, about 6 or 7 months ago, he asked me, "Is there any research question that you would not tackle in your scientific career that is too taboo?" And my answer is no. As long as you address the question honestly and objectively, there is nothing that should be off limits. Because then it becomes very easy to say, sex differences, we shouldn't study that because it might marginalize one sex or the other. Race differences, we shouldn't study them for the same reasons, and so on. That becomes forbidden knowledge. No, the highest ideal that any honest person should pursue is the pursuit of truth. So don't be encumbered by political correctness, just pursue the truth. And I think that one of the reasons that Jordan Peterson's message and my message have resonated now with a lot of people is because at least they see that we are ascribing to that ideal to the best of our abilities. Rogan, what if that truth hurts your feelings? Me, fuck your feelings. Rogan, gasping, oh! There are two fundamental ethical orientations that guide people's daily behaviors: deontological and consequentialist ethics. The former is an absolutist view of ethical standards. It is never correct to lie, whereas the latter evaluates the ethical merits of an action based on its consequences. It is at times acceptable to lie to spare someone's feelings. The reality is that most people operate under both systems. For example, if your wife asks you if she looks overweight, you will likely utter no without flinching, whatever you actually think. On the other hand, most people consider it morally wrong under all circumstances to make sexual advances on children. A deontological view regarding the pursuit of truth asserts that it is never justified to violate or suppress the truth. A consequentialist perspective asserts that the truth must at times be altered, fudged, or suppressed to avert such bad consequences as hurt feelings. Much of the lunacy that we see from the, quote, progressive camp is a result of consequentialism when it comes to the truth. Any human endeavor rooted in the pursuit of truth must rely on facts and not feelings. Legal proceedings constitute one such domain. We do not establish the innocence or guilt of defendants using feelings. Rather, we rely on a broad range of available facts in making a case. The threshold for establishing guilt is set purposely high. The cumulative evidence must be beyond a reasonable doubt to convict someone. The evidentiary threshold for uncovering scientific truths is even more stringent than those expected within the legal arena. One problem we face today is that consequentialists make a virtue of having emotions cloud our judgments, not only to avoid hurt feelings, but because emotion is seen as a sign of authenticity. As British prison psychiatrist Theodore Dalrymple observed, "Is it not the case that we live in an age of emotional incontinence, when they who emote the most are believed to feel the most? Remember, though, that one's heartfelt outrage seldom says anything about the truth or falsehood of one's position. Donald Trump is going to end the world. When Donald Trump won the 2016 U.S. presidential election, I was bewildered at the mass psychogenic hysteria that engulfed my academic colleagues and the great majority of folks within my social circle. The stock market was going to crash and never recover. Trump was going to abolish democracy. Minorities were going to be endangered. He was about to usher in a nuclear holocaust. His supposed ties to white supremacists would marshal a new wave of genocidal anti-Semitism across North America. I decided to satirize this profound idiocy by releasing a clip on my YouTube channel showing me hiding under the table in my study to avoid being caught by Trump's Jew-hating death squads. I have since released several other installments of hiding under the table clips, including one upon the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh to the U.S. Supreme Court, and another shortly prior to hosting Professor Rachel Fulton Brown on my show. She had the, quote, audacity to write a blog post that lauded white men, since they were instrumental in leading the charge in founding the emancipatory freedoms that we now possess in the West, including women's rights. This led to her being accused of being a white supremacist and a merchant of hate by many of her colleagues, including Professor Dorothy Kim, who was supposedly existentially threatened by Brown's remarks, since Kim is a, quote, person of color. What explains such irrational hysteria, especially when promulgated by supposedly sophisticated academics? I've argued that Donald Trump represents a deep and visceral aesthetic injury to the sensibilities of those who reside in the highfalutin ivory tower. Trump is the antithesis of the restrained diplomat who delivers polished and seemingly eloquent messages of platitudinous hope. Can you think of a recent U.S. president who was a world champion at delivering such messages and who was revered by the intelligentsia as the last and final messiah? Perhaps a hint might prove helpful. That president won a Nobel Peace Prize, largely for having enriched the world with his message of love, peace, and hope. The nomination's deadline for the prize was 11 days after he was inaugurated. As such, his Nobel Prize was awarded for accomplishments that he achieved prior to becoming president. Some people win Nobel Prizes by being held prisoner for 27 years in their quest to fight apartheid, Nelson Mandela. Others win it for sporting a winning, radiant smile of sunny hope. They are equally worthy winners, and if you think otherwise, you are a racist. Barack Obama is majestic in his personal style. He is tall, thin, and elegant. His elocution and speech cadence are melodious. He is polished in a way that appeals to those who become drunk by merely smelling the cork of a wine bottle, an Arabic expression. Donald Trump, on the other hand, is a brash and cantankerous brawler. The unhinged, quote, progressives, best exemplified by the utterly deranged Robert De Niro, are irrevocably and perpetually outraged by him. They are viscerally disgusted. They possess no theory of mind that might allow them to place themselves in the shoes of the nearly 63 million Americans who voted for Trump. Perhaps the ensuing analysis might help them see the light. Subsequent to the historic political upset that shook the world, I witnessed innumerable people, many of whom are supposedly rational and educated individuals, aping Hillary Clinton's deplorables position. According to this viewpoint, many of the nearly 63 million people who voted for Donald Trump are racist, toothless, redneck simpletons who sleep with their siblings. Of course, nowhere was this perspective more rampant than in the halls of academia. It is bafflingly moronic that sophisticated intellectuals could actually believe such nonsense. I offer an alternative account to explain Trump's victory using principles from behavioral decision theory. In short, if your average voter had five key issues in mind, scored each candidate on them, and weighted them in order of importance, it was easy to understand how perfectly reasonable and rational people might have voted for Donald Trump without being deplorable bigots. Or take a much simpler decision process, the lexicographic rule, which states that a voter will solely examine the issue most important to him and choose the candidate who scores higher on it. It is perfectly conceivable that if a voter were using this rule, he could have voted for Trump in a multitude of possible ways. Those who viscerally hated Trump could not see that on issues ranging from immigration policy to tax policy to regulatory policy to trade policy to foreign policy to the appointment of federal judges, Trump took positions that appealed to many thinking Americans who wanted, for instance, stronger border enforcement and America First foreign policy and trade agreements, constitutionalist judges, and deregulation and tax cuts. Trump campaigned on these policies, while Hillary's campaign focused on the evil of the orange man bad and his supporters. Those suffering from Trump derangement syndrome cannot see that for 63 million Americans, voting for Trump was an obviously rational decision. The Brett Kavanaugh debacle. Oftentimes when I comment about American politics, I remind people that I'm Canadian and do not have a dog in that fight. My positions are always based on first principles and are not in the least bit biased by a desire to be loyal to any political tribe. As an impartial observer of the Brett Kavanaugh affair, I was bewildered by the duplicity of Democratic politicians and their eagerness to dispense with a presumption of innocence as a non-negotiable legal standard. In a twist of gargantuan Democratic hypocrisy, the outlandish hashtag Believe All Women tenet apparently does not apply to the more credible accusation recently levied against Joe Biden. Several decades of scientific research have cast doubt on the accuracy of eyewitness testimony and the accuracy of human memory in legal settings. And yet, Democratic politicians were perfectly willing to ignore first principles, including a presumption of innocence, and a large corpus of scientific evidence, and instead were decidedly eager to unequivocally believe testimony about an event that may or may not have taken place nearly four decades earlier. Political tribalism, fueled by emotional indignation, superseded logic, science, and reason. Once it became evident that the FBI could not uncover any corroborative evidence in support of Christine Blasey Ford's accusation, the Democrats moved the goalposts. The new deal-breaker regarding Kavanaugh's candidacy was his supposed lack of, quote, judicial temperament. He was too emotionally labile, too unhinged to be a sober member of the highest court in the land. In other words, his detractors were now arguing that he did not possess the appropriate disposition to be a Supreme Court justice. His righteous indignation and justifiable disgust were not attributed to the situation at hand, but were wrongly placed on the shoulders of his innate character. This is precisely what psychologists refer to as the fundamental attribution error, namely, exaggerating the extent to which an individual's internal traits, his personality, are responsible for an observed reality, while failing to take the circumstances into account. In the case of Kavanaugh, he was accused of horrifying crimes, without any concrete evidence, that were devastating to his personal and professional reputation. Imagine his having to explain these accusations to his wife and young daughters. His irate impatience when interacting with some of the Democratic senators was not properly attributed to the grotesque injustice that had been levied against him, but to his volatile personality. I doubt that this misattribution was anything but willful on the part of his detractors. I have faced a similar misattribution whenever I've rolled up my sleeves and gone after someone forcefully on social media, typically on Twitter. I let loose and accordingly engage in rhetorical sparring that at times can be quite spicy, albeit nearly always in the spirit of fun jabbing. It always amazes me when some buffoon writes me to share his surprise at my, quote, belligerent disposition, after having seen how restrained, polite, and warm I appear in countless other settings. Well, how I might respond if accosted by violent muggers in a dark alley is radically different from how I behave when affectionately tucking my young children to bed. My personality does not magically change across the two scenarios. The situation does. Returning to the Kavanaugh case, no fair-minded individual could fail to attribute his understandable anger to anything but the situation at hand. And yet, the Democrats placed the full blame on Kavanaugh's, quote, intemperate temperament. In a ploy that would make Sigmund Freud beam with pride, the Democrats managed to project their emotional hysteria onto Kavanaugh. I'm outraged. I'm offended. In 2005, Lawrence Summers, then president of Harvard University, delivered a lecture at the National Bureau of Economic Research Conference on diversifying the science and engineering workforce. During his talk, he intimated the possibility that intrinsic sex differences might explain why women are underrepresented in these disciplines. Notwithstanding the fact that there are robust findings in the scientific literature that supported his contentions, he had committed a fatal error. To argue that men and women might exhibit dispositional differences is blasphemous within most halls of academia. Despite the fact that world-renowned Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker defended Summers' positions, he was forced to resign from Harvard. Shortly after Summers' lecture, the Harvard Crimson, a student newspaper, asked Pinker, "Were President Summers' remarks within the pale of legitimate academic discourse?" To which the psychologist brilliantly replied, "Good grief! Shouldn't everything be within the pale of legitimate academic discourse, as long as it is presented with some degree of rigor? That's the difference between a university and a madrasa. Incidentally, that there are fewer female faculty members in STEM fields is hardly due to sexist hiring practices. The exact opposite holds true as evidenced by the 2-to-1 preference exhibited by both male and female faculty members for prospective female hires in comparison to equally well-qualified male candidates. And yet, the victimhood narrative persists, unencumbered by facts." In July 2017, I delivered a lecture at the prestigious Talks at Google series in Mountain View, the main Google campus, on my scientific work at the intersection of evolutionary psychology and consumer behavior. Shortly thereafter, the now infamous Google memo written by James Damore went viral. In it, Damore argued that innate sex differences might explain why women were less likely to be interested in a career in high tech. Some thought that Damore had attended my Google lecture and that it might have emboldened him to release the memo. Alas, he confirmed to me that he was away in China when I had delivered my talk. Shortly after the memo went viral, Damore and I had our first communication, which was to set up a chat on my show. In a truly Orwellian moment, I was advised that if I wanted my Google lecture to be seen on the internet, I should wait until it was uploaded on the Google platform before I interviewed Damore. In any case, Damore was fired by Google, despite the fact that Google had expressly solicited comment on their diversity policies, and notwithstanding that Damore's positions were well supported by the scientific literature. If the truth hurts, it must be suppressed for the sake of diversity, inclusion, equity, and of course, community cohesion. Still, apparently not all academics have received the memo that scientific data cannot be used to question a politically correct narrative. Alessandro Strumia, a professor of physics at the University of Pisa and a fellow at CERN, the European Organization for Nuclear Research, learned this lesson the hard way. He delivered a lecture at an inaugural event organized by CERN titled Workshop on High Energy Theory and Gender. He presented several bibliometric analyses that questioned the prevailing victimhood narrative in physics, namely that women were discriminated against. For example, he found that across 18 countries, men had an extraordinarily higher number of citations than women when being hired for the same position. Ratios of male to female citations across the countries varied from 2.96 to 1 to 12.5 to 1. It would be perfectly reasonable to challenge his conclusions if one had competing data to present, but he was condemned, essentially, as a blasphemer and metaphorically burned at the stake. Several thousand scientists under the obnoxious banner of Particles for Justice signed a statement condemning Strumia. Their statement of condemnation contained countless misrepresentations unbefitting of supposedly unbiased and objective scientists, including the following lead sentence, bold in original, of the second paragraph, We write here first to state, in the strongest possible terms, that the humanity of any person, regardless of ascribed identities such as race, ethnicity, gender identity, religion, disability, gender presentation, or sexual identity, is not up for debate. This is a grotesquely dishonest tactic, as Strumia did not question anyone's humanity, let alone mention any of the listed identities. A powerful and brilliant rebuttal letter to that statement was penned by a physicist and published in Aereo magazine. The letter is precisely what one might expect of an intellectually honest and non-hysterical academic. It lays out the logical and scientific errors in the statement, as well as many of the mischaracterizations of Strumia's positions. It also conceded, even-handedly, that Strumia had, on occasion, been less than collegial. The long rebuttal was published anonymously because the author felt that, quote, anonymity is the wisest course. Although I am a genuinely liberal person, and although I have striven to be fair and conscientious, I fear attaching my name could harm my career and my relationships. I know that there are many other physicists who were also put off by the polemical nature of the response, and who would at least be willing to discuss these things privately, but the social atmosphere is toxic right now. That this physicist felt the need to publish his rebuttal anonymously is the most important takeaway from this whole debacle. While I commend the author for writing such a trenchant reply, I admonish him for lacking the testicular fortitude to channel his inner Martin Luther. Here I stand. I have weighed in on countless occasions about the Strumia case, including inviting him for a chat on my show, and have commented about matters that are extraordinarily more fear-inducing than this matter, such as critiquing Islam, and I've never done so under the cloak of anonymity. An honest signal of one's commitment to truth, reason, and justice must be costly for it to carry any weight. Still, one can understand the temptation of anonymity. A new journal, the Journal of Controversial Ideas, has announced that it will permit authors to publish their works under pseudonyms. The journal has many leading academics on its board, but that such a journal is required in supposedly free societies in the 21st century speaks volumes about the extent to which we are approaching the abyss of infinite intellectual darkness. That darkness will not be lightened by humor, because jokes and levity are also forbidden by progressives in academia. Sir Tim Hunt, a 2001 Nobel Prize winner, was giving a toast at the 2015 World Conference of Science Journalists in Seoul, South Korea, when he jokingly referred to the emotional predicaments that take place in mixed-sex labs. Let me tell you about my trouble with girls. Three things happen when they are in the lab. You fall in love with them, they fall in love with you, and when you criticize them, they cry. He then facetiously recommended same-sex labs to eliminate such pitfalls. The tsunami of outrage was swift and deadly. He was forced to resign from University College London and from the European Research Council. It did not matter that many leading female scientists came to his defense, as did Richard Dawkins, a scientist and one of Britain's leading public intellectuals. The reputation of this extraordinarily accomplished scientist, who had been a champion of women's participation in science for several decades, was shattered because of flippant comments made during a toast. That his own wife is a prominent scientist and a feminist did not give pause to the perpetually faux outraged and their lust for blood. Lazar Greenfield is a distinguished surgeon with a long list of scientific and clinical accomplishments. While serving as editor-in-chief of Surgery News, he authored an editorial in 2011 discussing research that women exposed to sperm via unprotected coitus had lower depression scores than their counterparts who engaged in protected sex. Greenfield concluded with a quip. So there's a deeper bond between men and women than St. Valentine would have suspected, and now we know there's a better gift for that day than chocolates. Cue the Taliban of faux outrage. This monster had to pay for his unforgivable humor. He was forced to resign as editor of Surgery News, as well as step down as president-elect of the American College of Surgeons. Stephen Platek, whom I know well, and who is one of the three authors of the paper that Greenfield had cited, penned a reply letter on behalf of his collaborators. How can someone be asked to resign for citing a peer-reviewed paper? Dr. Greenfield was forced to resign based on politics, not evidence. His resignation is more a reflection of the feminist and anti-scientific attitudes of some self-righteous and indignant members of the American College of Surgeons. Science is based on evidence, not politics. In science, knowing is always preferable to not knowing. But today in academia, progressive ideology trumps scientific facts. Matt Taylor is another scientist who crossed paths with the perpetually offended and rabidly outraged. In 2014, while being interviewed during a live stream about a breathtaking accomplishment of human ingenuity, he wore a rather obnoxious and, frankly, inappropriate shirt that included drawings of scantily clad women in various poses. Taylor had been working for the European Space Agency as an astrophysicist and was part of the team that landed the Philae probe on a rapidly moving comet located nearly 300 million miles away from our planet. The scientific and engineering expertise needed to pull off such a feat is truly astounding. This should have been his crowning moment. Alas, he is more likely to be remembered for his sartorial crime and his subsequent sobbing apology than for a truly momentous achievement. Of note, the shirt was made by Ellie Priseman, a female friend who had given it to Taylor as a gift. When interviewed about the matter, she replied, "Everyone is entitled to have an opinion. We would all be very boring if we felt the same way about everything. I can see both sides of the coin in this debate, but as it is a style I am into, I don't see it as offensive. But that is just my view. It is up to us to empower ourselves. We can achieve anything we want to if we have the skills and put our minds to it." The angry feminists who are willing to ruin the career of an accomplished scientist because of his idiotic shirt choice are also the ones likely to argue that the male gaze is a form of visual rape. They are the ones who posit that the patriarchy promulgates a beauty myth that compels women to beautify themselves. When parasitized by such a conspiratorial and delusional mindset, the bikini becomes a sexist tool of the patriarchy, whereas the burqa is liberating and freeing, since it averts the male gaze. To satirize this astonishing departure from reason, I began to use the hashtag #FreedomVeils hashtag in reference to this garb. Religious attire such as the hijab, niqab, and burqa that stem from profoundly patriarchal societies and are imposed on millions of women are liberating, according to many Western feminists. Bikinis, which under second wave feminism might be construed as empowering if used in the pursuit of sexual liberation, apparently are manifestations of the West's patriarchal misogyny. To recapitulate, bikinis, cosmetics, and miniskirts are bad. Shirts with whimsical drawings of scantily clad women are a capital offense. The burqa, niqab, and hijab represent feminist liberation from the male gaze. No satire can compete with progressive buffoonery. During my appearance on Sam Harris's podcast, I recounted how my wife and I had taken our daughter to play at a local children's park. Standing in the middle of the play area were some individuals so fully covered in black niqabs that we could not tell if they were women, men, or any of the 873, quote, genders that now constitute the rich fluidity of, quote, gender expression. The image was so jarring that we decided to leave. Since sharing this story, I have been derided by some Western bien-pensants for our silly overreaction. After all, what could be more engaging and fun than walking into a play area with a very young child and having ghosts in ominous black robes stare at your child? Surely only racist bigots would feel uncomfortable at such a symbol of secularism, modernity, and true liberalism. Of course I'm being sarcastic, because this is the only possible way to process such suicidal stupidity. Vision is the dominant sense for humans. We have evolved a highly specialized visual system that permits us to read a broad range of nonverbal cues, including facial features. Once a person's identity and humanity are hidden behind black robes of, quote, freedom and liberation, It is only natural for most sane people to feel uneasy about such a reality. And yet the virtue signalers mock, deride, and condemn those who exhibit perfectly rational responses to an otherwise disturbing stimulus. Clear-thinking people know that there is a place for both emotions and intellect, for humor and seriousness, and understand when to activate their emotional versus cognitive systems as they navigate life. But people who have fallen prey to idea pathogens have lost control of their minds and their emotions. And these pathogens are spreading rapidly and threatening our freedom. Chapter 3. Non-negotiable elements of a free and modern society. But the peculiar evil of silencing the expression of an opinion is that it is robbing the human race, posterity, as well as the existing generation, those who dissent from the opinion, still more than those who hold it. If the opinion is right, they are deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. If wrong, they lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth produced by its collision with error. John Stuart Mill. What are the essential features that a society must possess in order to be truly liberal and modern? Neil Ferguson, the Harvard historian, proposed 6 killer apps that define the greatness of the West, namely competition, scientific revolution, property rights, modern medicine, consumer society, and work ethic. In this chapter, I offer a more distilled set of factors. I posit that the guaranteed right to debate any idea, freedom of speech and thought, coupled with a commitment to reason and science to test competing ideas, the scientific method, are what have made Western civilization great. Social media companies and free speech. Many people in the West have a poor understanding of the concept of free speech. Whenever I mute or block someone on social media, a cacophony of fools will accuse me of being a free speech hypocrite for silencing their voice. They do not understand that I have the right to walk away from their online taunts, insults, and idiocy. To do so is not restricting their speech, but expressing my right to avoid listening to them. This is an obvious point, and yet many people are confused by it. A second mistake is the mindlessly aped line, "Social media companies are not the government. They have the right to choose which content will be carried on their platforms." In a sane world, this would be a laughable position to hold, and yet it is endlessly repeated without any reflection on its nefarious implications. Google, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter have more global control over us than all the other companies combined. It is not hyperbole to say that they have more collective power in terms of the information they control than all the rulers, priests, and politicians of history. If knowledge is power, then these social media giants are nearly all powerful when they decide which information we can have and whether we can be allowed a social media platform. Big tech companies routinely ban right-leaning commentators. But of course, this is all an unfortunate, quote, algorithmic coincidence. What could be more sinister? Another tool that online companies use to repress free speech is going after your wallet. Of the 1,000-plus clips on my YouTube channel, roughly 1/3 have been demonetized, albeit some are monetized again once I file a request for manual review. Many of my clips are demonetized prior to my even posting them publicly. In other words, an algorithm automatically demonetizes my clips as a default setting. In other instances, money exchange portals such as Patreon and PayPal, which are used by online content creators to solicit financial support, have banned individuals whom they feel have violated one of their tenets of acceptable speech. Carl Benjamin, aka Sargon of Akkad, an influential YouTuber on whose show I have appeared on 2 occasions, was booted from Patreon. The company had uncovered a clip where he used the N-word as a means of mocking racists. Despite this context, and the fact that the clip had not been produced on the Patreon platform, a key feature of their terms of use, and hence not supported by his patrons, they deleted his account. This caused a gigantic backlash against Patreon. My good friends Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin left the platform in protest, and many people pledged to boycott the company. But the boycott indirectly punished many other content creators who lost a huge amount of revenue. It cost me more than 2/3 of my financial support. As a libertarian, I am a fervent proponent of small government. I despise the never-ending and ever-increasing governmental encroachments into our daily lives. But it seems obvious that these online companies must be regulated as utilities. Just as your electricity or phone line is not shut off if the electric company or phone company doesn't like what you say, social media platforms should not be in the business of monitoring and punishing speech. Self-censorship is the greatest scourge to free speech. As a result of my public engagement, I have become a global confessor for students and academics suffering under the political correctness that dominates our universities. A common theme in these first-person testimonies is the necessity of self-censorship, lest one be punished for violating progressive orthodoxy. The fear is so great that professors thanking me for my defense of classical liberal values often request that I not share their identities, which I never do without their permission. Imagine for a moment how chilling this is. Below, I share excerpts of a few representative emails sent to me. I'm a 47-year-old white male who, because of an injury, made a choice to return to school. In the first year, to maintain full-time status, I was forced to take another social justice Black Lives Matter course. Students are not allowed to challenge or question the course content because that's considered disrespectful and may disrupt someone's safe space. I believe I'm a respectful student with good attendance and whose marks are in the mid-80s. That said, after a few weeks of the one-sided syllabus, I'm considering dropping out of the program and